This is Dee Blick. Welcome to Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Hello and a warm welcome to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, for UK Health Radio, the world's biggest talk health radio station. It's lovely to have your company today. Now, on today's show, I have got a truly inspiring individual, a former soldier who threw his all into everything so that he could be in peak physical fitness, who then went on and had PTSD, bounced back from that, and is now one of the most emotionally connected, inspiring, warm, and relatable people that I know. And it's just lovely that I have got him on my show today. So, a warm welcome, Danny Rowe.
Thank you, Dee. It's an absolute pleasure to be here with you and an honour to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Well, I can't wait for you to share your story with our lovely listeners, because it is indeed a compelling one. And I really want to start actually in an unusual place, which is your LinkedIn profile. Now, on this, you describe yourself as a British Army veteran. And I'd love to know, what inspired you to join the Army? Was it a long-standing desire since childhood, or were you following in family footsteps?
No, not at all. So when I was 15 years old, I had no one in the family who served in the military. I had no friends who had served, because obviously they were all my age, all very young. So I didn't know anyone personally. In terms of inspiration, oddly, I was reading books like Bravo 2-0 and The One That Got Away. I'm not entirely sure why I was reading books like that, like that at that age, but they really captivated me because I really found their heroism and their struggle, and just, it made me question my own potential, because I thought, well, if these amazing soldiers can achieve so much and under such difficult circumstances and survive, maybe there's more to me. So that caught my interest. And then at the time, the Army was advertising on the radio. I think the slogan at the time was Army, be the best. And and I really just wanted to be someone. And I thought, what better way to do it than to be a soldier? So when I voiced, then I went to Bristol and I went to the careers office and signed up. And when I voiced that to people in my circle, they all doubted me and they thought, you, military? Nah. And wow. And that made me even more determined. So I thought, no, I'm going to go ahead with this, and I'm going to join up.
Gosh, and how old were you when you actually were starting to read these profound books?
So I'd be around 15 years old. So pretty young.
That is very young. And I think, I mean, when we've chatted before, you mentioned that you were bullied at school. And do you think that sort of ongoing, I don't know how long you were bullied for, perhaps you could share, but was part of that being bullied this desire to be strong and to better yourself? Did this feed into your desire to become a soldier?
I think so, yeah, because I think bullying is a form of rejection. It's that your peers or people around you rejecting who you are as a person. So for me to be in military, it was a form of me saying, no, I'm something now. And so it was kind of transcending that suffering of being bullied.
You sound like quite mentally resilient and aware young man to be going through that, to being bullied, reading these profound books. That's one thing, but actually wanting to go into the military is another. And how long were you bullied for?
Quite a while. Yeah, it was. It's quite a while. Yeah,
it's insidious. I find bullying. I really identify with you that, because I was bullied at school. I was the little girl with ginger hair, overweight, acne, and I was bullied for quite a few years. And I think you develop it's a thick skin, but inside you're falling apart, because you're right, you desperately want, I wanted to be one of the cool girls, and I wasn't one of the cool girls. And for me, it's interesting to hear that you immersed yourself in reading, because even from being a little girl, I developed this profound love affair with reading and with writing stories. And it was a way of escapism. You know, it really was. And then you wake up on the morning and your heart's heavy because you're walking into school and you know that when you get in there, and I tried to befriend the bullies, which I look back on it now and it just seems so sad. I just wondered, did you ever talk about it? Because I didn't really talk about being bullied. I just absorbed it and accepted that that was part of being in a very working class kind of tough school.
I didn't talk about it. So for me, my way of dealing with it was to isolate. So I used to do a lot of computer programming. So I'd buy these great big books and I'd sit in my room and I'd code for hours and hours. And in your room, you're safe. No one's going to hurt you. So that was kind of how I dealt with it. So I isolated. And that was part of the reasons why I joined the army, because I felt that I wanted a bit more. Not to say there's anything against computer programming, but I didn't want to be isolated in my room in that sort of environment. So I thought, no, I want to get out. I want to do something physical. I want to become a man. And that's, that's kind of what prompted that decision.
I feel that's something we'll unpack later in the show. But gosh, I think what a motivational speaker you would be, being able to share that, and what a flame of hope that you'd hold out for young people. I think it's great today that so many young people, that there's support, it's recognized that bullying is not acceptable and there are support routes. So I am full of admiration for you that not only did you manage to get through the bullying, but you channeled it into something hugely positive. And I want to ask you now, before joining the army, did you have in your mind's eye an idea what life would be like as a soldier? Because I know, as we've spoken before, your reality was quite different. You're reading these books, you're thinking, wow, this is the career for me. Did you have a vision of what it might be like for you as a soldier?
Not really, no. So my only insight was from books and from film. So at the time, there was films like Saving Private Ryan, which was a classic. But, you know, it seems like we've had technology forever, but when I joined, we didn't have things like YouTube. There wasn't Facebook or anything like that. So, you know, nowadays you can go online, you can see, you know, you can look at Afghanistan, for example, you see all the stuff that goes on. I had none of that. So yeah, it was a pure leap of faith. I knew that it'd be very difficult, you know, and I had a rough idea what it'd be like, but nothing crystal clear.
What was your selection process like? So you went and applied on this. I remember the advertising campaign of Be the Best. Tell me a bit about the selection process before you got that letter saying you're in.
Yeah, so I wanted to be infantry. So the academic requirements were quite limited. So basically, I had to do a selection, which from memory, I think it was a 1.5-mile run. And you had to do it within a certain amount of time. It might have been like 11 minutes or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, whatever it was, I just scraped through. And I think there had been some other tests. But basically, you do selection. And then I passed that. And then basically, within months, I think it was January 2004, I then started my training. So because it wasn't a long-standing dream, there was no preparation from my point of view. I lived a very sedentary lifestyle. So it's very much like, oh, fancy joining the military, and then next minute, before I know it, I'm in.
Wow.
I'm training.
So if I could, just let's stay on that point. So I want to take you back then. How old were you at the point of being accepted into the army?
So early 16. So I would have just, 16 in August. So I think it was probably about October, November time I would have done selection. So yeah, 16 years old.
I just wonder, when you announced that you were joining the army, you're being bullied, how did the bullies react? How did your family react? It's quite a big thing.
My parents were shocked, particularly with me wanting to join the infantry. Their view on it was, well, why do you want to do that? You know, just going to be cannon fodder, you're intelligent, why don't you do something else? But for me, I was just captivated by these books, and that's something I really wanted to do. I was just determined to do it.
And what about the people at school? Because, I mean, I presume then you're still at school, or had you just left?
No, I just left. So it was just after my GCSEs. And I think that's why the army were doing their campaign. They're capturing, you know, people's interest. Just left school. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do in my life. And so I guess in a bit of a panic, I was like, well, let's join the military. Why not?
Yeah, absolutely. And look what's happened since then. I mean, it's quite incredible, really. I can remember when I left school, I think the bullying was still there, but I got a really good job. And I remember at the first reunion, going to a school reunion, and by that time, I think I'd grown into being a woman. I was quite well presented. I'd lost the weight. And I was really confident in my appearance. And the reaction I got from some of those girls that bullied me, it was really quite, oh, gosh, look at you. And there was a kind of a pleasure of thinking, yeah, you know what? I've made something of myself. I've not let being bullied define me. And I just wonder if there was a sense of that with you.
Yeah, so when I was going for the training, I came home very much. I saw people's reactions, and I remember one moment when I saw one guy, and his look of me towards me, and I realised I was never going to be bullied again. He was shocked at my change.
I mean, I think that's the most wonderful thing when you just know that you're not destined to live in this pit of despair, because I think being bullied, without a doubt, you are in a pit of despair. You might temporarily get out of it, but that feeling of, I'm not in this anymore. And there's almost that defiance of, I'm going to show me and I'm going to show you just what I am made of that makes it. I always think it makes any subsequent success all the more enjoyable and more deep-seated, because you've got the then and now. You know, you can go back and look at then and then think, wow, look where I've come from. And it's quite a remarkable feeling, isn't it?
100%. And what I would add to that is the way to win against bullies is to be happy and successful. So that's how I try and live my life. I just try and be happy and be successful. And that's why I've had so much strength, because, you know, it's not about me giving up. It's about me proving the people that doubt me right. I don't want to prove them right. I don't want their lies about me to come true.
No. How incredible. Now, don't go away. We're coming to the first break. And after that, I'm going to be talking to Danny about his physical fitness when he was actually a soldier and the remarkable things that he did to become the leader of the group instead of the laggard.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and a warm welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick. And I've got the fabulous Danny Rowe, the British Army veteran, in the studio today. So, Danny, before the break, we were talking about bullying, and I want to take you back to when you were a soldier, because you mentioned that you scraped through in that initial induction process. You just scraped through on the running, on the physical fitness. And I want to ask you about how did the reality of being a soldier compare with the idea, and what you can share about your lived experience. And I'd love it if you can share the story of how you became physically incredibly robust.
So the difference between what I thought of being the military and how it was in reality was very different. So reading about other people suffering is very different to suffering yourself. You know, you have these ideas when you read a book and you think, yeah, I can do that. But when you're actually experiencing it over a long period of time, it's very difficult, and you really need your mental resilience to get through that. As I said before, I wasn't naturally athletic, so I was on the back foot. A lot of my peers at the time had very athletic childhoods. They were, you know, always doing sports. I just wasn't that. So the problem I had is I had to gain an advantage over them. And the only way I could do that was by doing additional training. So when the day's training was over, I would strap on a Bergen and I would do extra just to try and, because the problem I had is as I was getting fitter, they were getting fitter as well. And you could say that in life as well, you know, as we're progressing in our life, other people are progressing. So the only way to win is to outwork people. So that was kind of my philosophy. The other culture shock was, I remember a moment where our sergeant, he was artillery. He had a massive chest and I always looked up to him because the artillery shells are really heavy. And he basically said to me and everyone else that you need to switch on or you're going to die. And it was at that moment where I really started to conceptualize what I had actually signed up for. You know, we were training to go to war. You know, once we passed that training, if the military said, right, you've got to go to this location and go to war, that's what I was. So it changed the fitness for me. It was kind of like, it wasn't about being faster. It was about being physically robust enough to survive and to not die. I love the camaraderie in amongst everyone. When you're suffering with other people, it creates a bond, a unity, because you're all going through the same pain. And then lastly, I just felt really amazing when I passed out and I saw people before me, from my old life, and nothing had really changed. It was like going back in time, and I had changed so much, but other people hadn't necessarily. And I stood up tall with my chest out and my shoulders back, and I just felt I had a huge amount of self-respect for myself.
I bet you did. And I just want to take you back to, you had this Bergen that's Bergen, you've had a full day, which I would imagine is physically and mentally tiring. At the end of that, you're deciding, I'm going to go out and I'm going to run. But didn't you become you got a certificate and you became the fastest runner out of the whole gang?
So I was awarded the most improved junior soldier in recognition of the fact that I'd progressed so much from where I was. And the army is designed that no matter what your fitness, basically they try to break you down and then build you back up. So everyone goes through that. But yeah, my progress was pretty incredible. And it was because I was doing that extra bit.
I find this absolutely fascinating that you're this, I'm taking you back to when you're a young boy, you're reading these books, you're being bullied, but you've got this kind of mental core that is quite tough, quite resilient. You probably didn't even realise it at the time, but then you're coming into the army and you're not being bullied, but you're being made aware that if you don't get faster, quicker, you're not going to make it. So it's that mental resilience of that young man. It's been with you right up to this point. So you're thinking, I'm not going to just take this. I'm actually going to be the fastest in did you call it the squadron? That's my naivety. What do you call it? I said group, but it's not group, is it?
Yes,
is it
your squadron or platoon, yeah.
Yeah. So you say, I'm going to be the fastest in the squadron. Were you, when I say, were you mentally aware, were you very much aware that this is a tool that you're going to deploy? I'm going to focus my resilience, my toughness, my mind onto the task, or was it just intuitive? Right, okay, I'm going to have to pick myself up and get faster. I'm trying to get an insight into your psyche at that point in time.
I think there was a mixture of things. So the one, you know, thing I'd say was fear of death is you know, we all have that fear. So I didn't want to die, so that's why I wanted to be as physically robust as I could. Second of all, in terms of the mental resilience, I wouldn't say I was consciously aware of it. I was just focused on survival. So my way of coping with that, which helped me a lot, was I had this unwavering belief that I would never give up. The only way I was going to leave was if they forced me out. And now looking back in hindsight, that was a pivotal belief for me. And when I saw other people give up and leave, it gave me more and more confidence. And I realized that if you go through life and you just refuse to give up and you keep moving forward, you become unstoppable. You can achieve things that you never imagined you could ever achieve.
I think that is quite profound and I agree with you. And I was also, you mentioned about you came out of the army and you bumped into somebody that had bullied you and they're a bit like, what on earth has gone on here? Who is this guy? And it reminded me that I came back from university. We lived in a council house, it wasn't brilliant, but it gave us a roof over our heads. And at the top of the street, there was I won't give her name just in case she's still around, but she was a really attractive girl and she was part of the bullies. And it was more verbal bullying. You know, you get the odd shoveling, but insults really can go quite deep, and particularly if you're very self-conscious. And I can remember walking up the road coming back from uni and I was really confident and her stopping me. And she said, oh, goodness me, look at you. I'll never forget that look at you. And I thought, yeah, I've changed. I'm kind of blossoming into the person that I'm destined to be, rather than having that label on me of being bullied or weak or not feeling great about. I had quite bad body dysmorphia. And I think that's quite a nice, it's the unintended byproduct of when you start to fulfill your dreams and you also build your mental resilience. It's quite incredible because you're not going out to people saying, look at me. You're just exuding a confidence that is inside out. And that's quite a powerful thing. And so I can imagine you feeling in that situation. But of course, I didn't have the fear of death, which is quite profound. Had I had the fear of death? We've got a couple of minutes to the next break. And I just want to talk a bit about your mental resilience as a soldier, because obviously being a soldier, it's physical and it's mental. What would you say is a split between mental and physical in terms of what you need to marshal the most? Or does it depend on the situation you're in?
I think for me, it was more mental than physical, although it's physically challenging, don't get me wrong. But the army, the demands of the army, you're never going to be physically enough. There's always room for more. It's your mind that keeps you going. It's your mind that moves that leg and, you know, your foot in front of the other. So mental resilience was absolutely everything. And for me, it was just about just the thing is, when you're under a great amount of stress and life is difficult, you've got to change your time frame. So for me, at that time, I couldn't look ahead the next year or 5 years. All I could look ahead was maybe the next day, the next hour, the next 10 minutes. Sometimes it could be the next lamppost or the next thing in the distance. You just got to adjust your time frame to what you can manage. And then you just keep doing that and repeating it and repeating it. And eventually you'll get to where you want to be, or life will get a bit easier. And then you can start changing the time frame to a longer time frame. And that was really what it was for me. It's just survival.
Gosh, so we've got literally a minute to the break. And I just want to ask you now, looking back over your career in the army as a British Army veteran, how would you sum up what that experience gave you to shape you as a man and to move you on to the next stage of your life?
It gave me the belief that if I voluntarily choose to suffer, there's no limit to what I can achieve. I don't believe life is... I don't think it's good to chase pleasure. I'm not saying pleasure isn't good. I think we need to pick a challenge, something that's difficult, something that sustains us. And I think happiness and joy comes from the progress, not from reaching our destination. So if you're in a rut, just pick something difficult, go out for a run or whatever it may be, just something that's difficult. And then just keep progressing.
Yeah. I find that, but again, that's quite profound. I love that about picking something that challenges you, because it's that, I think I was speaking about this with my last guest, Debbie Gilbert, that my coach, Laura, says to me whenever I push myself into a new space, she says it's courage over comfort, Dee. And I think, wow, that is so true, that when I'm doing things that take me out of my comfort zone, the courage propels me, then it becomes comfortable because I become that, they call it in the learning wheel, an unconscious competent. I'm just doing it naturally. But if I want to really push myself, I have to accept that the happy road to destiny is going to be met with uncomfortable moments because I'm developing. And I think once we accept that of courage over comfort, suddenly it becomes like an opportunity for growth rather than something to be fearful of. And I think that simple phrase has really changed it for me. And I've just realized now we're coming up to the second break. Don't go away, because after the break, Danny is going to be talking about how when he came out of the army, he had post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm going to get him to talk more about this and how he's built himself to be such an emotionally in tune and mentally resilient young man. Can I call you young man? Is that a bit of an old-fashioned phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, sure,
man?
Yeah.
I sound like one of these, you know, elderly young men.
I've been called worse things.
Yeah, pat you on the head. All right, don't go away.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong? I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, and the wonderful Danny Rowe talking about his life as a British Army veteran. So, Danny, you've now left the Army, and by your own admission, you suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. Can you share more about this?
Yeah, sure. So when I left, the military is a very structured way of life, so you don't really have to think too much. What I mean by that is, you know, you're told where you're going to be. You don't have to worry about food. You've got your accommodation. Everything's sorted for you. And then you leave, and it's like your entire identity is gone. You know, you're not a soldier anymore. You're just a random. You're just another person. So I lost all that, and so I did have a sense of anxiety about. And also when you're with peers that are doing the same thing, there's no real comparison because you're all the same. But then when you go out, it's like you're meeting people from all walks of life on different journeys. And so I had this fundamental belief, and I'm not entirely, I have a rough idea where it came from, but I had this belief that there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't enough. And so when I was in social situations, for example, I would always say, you know, that person's probably more intelligent than me, more better than me, more wealthy, whatever it may be. And so I suffered with a lot of anxiety, which got quite bad. I wouldn't recommend that. But I've learned over time that actually we are enough, and we shouldn't compare ourselves to other people, because it's just a recipe for anxiety and happiness.
Didn't you seek professional help as well for your PTSD?
I did, yeah. So I met an amazing clinical psychologist who completely transformed my life, and I owe a lot of gratitude to him for that. Basically, we looked at my core beliefs and rules for life, and I found that they weren't helping me. So, for example, if you imagine a baby, you know, a baby is just pure innocence. You know, there's no malevolence in a baby. And then they grow up into a child, and that child has a series of positive and negative experiences. And so they form core beliefs about the world and themselves. And it could be, for example, that, you know, you're not enough or you're unlovable. And then you develop these rules for life of, you know, and sometimes they help us, but sometimes they hinder us. And I had a series of beliefs that just weren't helping me, and they were making me miserable. So we unpacked that. And I also learned a lot about manipulation, psychological games. And I realized that I had people in my life that really weren't doing me good. And once you see manipulation, you can't unsee it.
No.
You know the tricks. So I cut a lot of people out of my life, and I've reintroduced people that are great. I don't have a massive social circle, but the people I have in my life generally want the best for me. They're really, yeah, really decent, kind people. And my life is infinitely better for it. So I'm selective about who I allow in my life now.
So it's quite a profound journey again. Was there a point, you're going through this process, which I so identify with, of seeking help. At what point did you see the clouds lifting, the sun coming out, and you're thinking, do you know what? I've now got enough within me. I can move forward again with a bit more of a spring in my step. Was there an epiphany or a particular point where you just thought, yep, I'm now in that space where I can now move ahead with the same confidence you had going into the Army, and now you're going into a stage of your life where you feel you're more in control, you've got the answers, and you've got a life plan. Was there anything particular that happened to make you see the sunshine?
It happened surprisingly quick. So I was very lucky by being a veteran. I met an amazing charity called Walking with the Wounded. They agreed to pay 8 sessions. So that was the plan, was just do 8 sessions. And my transformation was very quick. And I think a lot of it I owe to the fact that this amazing man, my psychologist, he just believed in me. And you know, and sometimes belief from someone else can make all the world a difference. And also validation, actually, what I was experiencing wasn't normal.
Yeah.
And, you know, the things that I got used to, just I didn't have to accept. So I learned about boundaries, and I learned about all sorts of different strategies. And I realized that actually the lies that people told me about me weren't true. I actually wasn't those things. I was actually a decent human being, and I just needed to learn to accept myself for who I am and adopt strategy so I can't be affected by other people's malevolence.
Yes. Yeah. I find that so moving. I know that when I came into recovery from addiction, my first year was really hard because all my childhood trauma resurfaced and I had to get help for that. I learned that I'd had the whack-a-mole, that I'd been bobbing along using alcohol as an anesthetic to either make me feel better or make me feel even more joyful, even more out of control. And I can remember that first year, and there was part of me, and I'm sure, I think having spoken to you before, there was a big part of me just thought, you're going to get through this. Even though it felt pretty terrible at the time, I have this faith that I'm on a different path now. I'm choosing to be in control of my life. I'm not choosing to dampen everything down with booze. But sometimes I think therapy, it can be painful, but if you stick at it, my goodness me, it's like the landscape, suddenly the horizon is pretty damn fantastic, isn't it? And I want to now talk, because I know you came out of the army and you went into the family business, and you made quite an impact there because the previous person had been somebody that you decided, I'm not going to be like that. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, so when I first arrived, I noticed there was a somber atmosphere amongst the staff. There was papers all over the wall, like, do this, don't do that, you know, very, very passive aggressive. And I thought, oh, there's a problem here. So I'm a very empathetic person. I have an empathetic style of leadership. So the first thing I wanted to address was to make sure people could feel safe enough that they could talk. So I had an open door policy. We got rid of all the paper, and we got rid of blame culture and all that. We just made it a nice environment. So, because that's half the battle, isn't it? If you can go to a job and just enjoy it and you know, feel like it's a nice environment, then, you know, and that's what I wanted to create for people after what they've been through. So that, had a big impact.
I listened to you sharing that, and I'm thinking about, there's two things that came to mind then. One was, you're a young boy, you've been bullied, so there's a really strong streak in you that thinks, I'm never going to put anybody through this again. You go into the army where there's rigidity, there's not a lot of flexibility, you obey the rules. And I just think that it sounds to me like you're a really smart person, able to mold yourself to a situation, because then you're going into the family business, but your true nature shines through. You could have gone in there and thought, yep, rules and regulations are what's needed, because you came from an army career where rules and regulations were what is needed. But you come into the family business, and the empathetic side of your character, the person that knows what it feels like to be bullied, you're actually bringing him into the workplace at that point. And I just wonder, were you consciously aware of that, or was it just the intuitive way for you to be?
I think it was a mixture of both. So I did a degree when I was in the army voluntarily in business. So I started to question the military style. Now, the military style of leadership has a purpose, and it's perfect for the military. You know, when you're on a battlefield, you don't want to be having a debate. You need to make a decision and get on with it. But in the civilian world, it's very different. This directive, authoritarian style might have worked many years ago, but it doesn't work now. So my view is that I'm not there to direct and to control. I'm there to serve. So and that served me very well in life. And I think that strategy should emerge. You know, people on the front line, they know what's going on. So to try and direct and tell them every you know, give them strict rules, it doesn't work. You need to take their insight and use it and serve them.
Yeah, you know, that's a bit of a mic drop you've just introduced there. You said, oh, I did a degree in the same way, like you said, oh, I had a coffee. Tell me about this degree that you did in the army.
So as part of wanting to develop myself and be better, so I signed up to the Open University. So I did that whenever I had spare time. I studied, yeah. So I, to my amazement, I did three years, which is quite, it came insane. At a personal cost, I must say, but in terms of the impact on me, but it was worth it. And I learned a lot about leadership. And I started to question everything. And I realized that if I was to go into a leadership position in the civilian world, the military, what I learned in the military, while it has its use, it needed to be tailored because it just wouldn't work. You know, you can't go in screaming, shouting and all that.
Wow. So even when you're in the army, you're excelling, you suddenly become the leader of the group at the running because you're putting your mind to it. And you also decide, as you would, that you're going to study for a degree. And so, when you started studying for that degree, was it because you had an eye for life beyond the army? So were you actually, in a parallel way, preparing yourself for life beyond the army?
There was a bit of both. So there's a part of me that had aspirations to be an officer. And at the time, you needed a degree. I didn't have the education. So I wanted to do that. But also, there's a part of me that knew that the thing of education is once you've got it, no one can take it away.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, if I gain education, you know, even if I don't use it, I haven't lost anything. So I just thought, gosh, I may as well just do it.
I remember when I actually applied for a degree, and thankfully I managed to do 3 years, it was the same sort of thing. That at the time when I went to university, I think it was 3% of graduates, 3% of students went on to higher education to get a degree. And because we came from quite a poor background where people from my socioeconomic group did not go to university, part of me thought, I really need to pack this and get a degree, very much like you, because nobody can take it away from me. And when you're bullied, there's always that feeling that you can be taken away. You can suddenly be submerged beneath it. And I remember just thinking, I want to make something of myself, because like you, I recognized that a degree was going to give me a bit of a passport. And it did. It did in the end, because in those days you just didn't get many degrees. And it was such a great starting point for me in my career. And, you know, I've just got to tell this story, Danny. When you were sharing about studying for your degree, it takes me back to I was a soldier in Afghanistan. He bought one of my books. I think he bought the Ultimate Small Business Marketing book. And he contacted me and said that when he had downtime, he was studying my book with a view to starting a business when he came out of the army. And we struck up a correspondence, and it was fantastic because he was there in the army in active, it was actually in active combat. And then he said, I've got your book under my pillow, and at night I'm getting it out, I'm reading it, and I'm studying it. And actually, I've got to tell you the conclusion to that story, that we were on a call for about 20 minutes, then the line went dead, and about 20 minutes later, I got a phone call from his girlfriend who was based in Germany. He was in Afghanistan. And she said, oh, blank name, just wants to apologize for the line cutting out. But they came under active shelling from the Taliban. And I was like, goodness me. Thankfully, everything was okay. And he came out of the army and we maintained correspondence. But I can still remember thinking then, that is quite phenomenal. Here's this young man in the army, and he's using my book to study about starting his own business when he comes out. And I have that vision of you, you know, doing this OU degree, that you've got one eye on the career when you come out of the army, one eye on perhaps going to the next level. And you're doing that, then you're strapping your Bergen on and getting your certificate for being most improved, which I think just sums up so much about your mental and your physical resilience. And I want to now just talk a bit about your emotional intelligence, because in the short time that I've known you, your emotional intelligence shines through, and you've got this philosophical outlook on life. And I just want to know, where does it come from and where are you today? Are you still, I mean, when I speak to you, you're so profoundly mature and you've got this, do they call it third eye, EQ? You've got like bags of that. And I'm thinking, are you still working on that today? You know, where clearly the journey began when you were 15, but just talk a bit about this journey that you're on.
That's a great question. So for me, I think emotional intelligence comes from pain. I think when you experience pain, you have empathy for other people, because you know that you know, when you look at a person, you first meet them, you don't know their story. And people have incredible stories and things they go through, but you don't always know. So, and for me also is this fundamental belief that I thought something was wrong with me. So I did a lot of introspection. I looked at self-help. Thankfully, I got therapy as well, which helped greatly. But I think it's not ideal if you go through life thinking that you are all that you could be. I think there's always room to grow. But I think we need to accept that and then look inside. And so the more I've looked inside, the more I've learned about myself. And then I've noticed patterns, you know, like addictions are a great subject, for example. So, you know, when you understand the pain that you know, someone's going through, you understand the addiction. People look at the addiction, but that's the wrong way of looking at it. It's a coping mechanism. So when you gain that intelligence and you understand that humans are actually quite logical. You know, if I, for example, experienced your life and your experiences, I'd end up exactly the same as you, as you know, love. I mean, in a positive way. And I think that for everyone, if I see someone, even if someone I don't particularly like, and I'm like, oh, I don't like their behavior. If I know that if I was them and I went through their same experiences, I would be that exact same person. So, and that's why, yeah, and that's how I've been able to really understand people. And I think, okay, let's not look at the behavior. Let's look at what's that person been through? What was their childhood like? And yeah.
So do you think now that have you got this, we call it self-love, this healthy self-esteem, you've moved from what's wrong with me to there's so much that is right with me and worth celebrating. Are you in that emotional and mental space now?
I'm in a much better place than I was. I have an amazing wife who's very supportive. You know, I have my down days like we all do, but she's very supportive and she brings out the best in me. I have great friends in my life now. I don't have the toxic type of people that would make me feel rubbish. And one of the downsides of being empathetic is you can naturally attract the wrong sorts of people in your life. People have a, you know, sense it. And so I've learned that I'm happy to help people and I enjoy helping people, but I'm also not as naive as I was before. And I know that they're not nice people and the wrong types, and I keep them out of my life because life is short. You know, surround yourself with good people and you'll be more likely to have a good life.
I agree. And as I'm listening to you, and I know we've spoken about this before, and I certainly will be cheering you on if you decide to do it. When I listen to you and in our previous conversations, I think there's got to be a book here and also motivational speaker. I just think you would be such a powerful motivational speaker because you've got such gravitas. You've got this incredible story. You've endured the ups and the downs of life. You've put yourself in physical and mentally demanding situations and you've stayed true. You're very emotionally aware. Is that something that you've considered writing a book and becoming a this is a random question I'm throwing in here, and becoming a motivational speaker. When I say that, does it make you have chills or shivers of excitement?
Not at all. No, it's a hell of a compliment from you to say that, and I really appreciate that. But yeah, I have thought of it before because I've come to the conclusion in my life that the more you try to win at life, the more you lose. The way to win, to truly win, is to help others. And I've always, you know, when I look back in my life, whenever I've been able to help people, I've always felt an immense amount of joy. And I think that's just, and business is, you could argue that business is helping people. You know, if you have a product or service and that changes people's lives, you're going to do well. So the idea of, and also I've always had this natural instinct to sort of ease other people's suffering. So if I can help someone who's having a difficult time and I can see the psychology that might be causing that suffering, I try and help. And that's why I have the courage to be vulnerable and authentic and open about my struggles. Because when you're silent, there's other people that have the same experience. You just don't know it. So when you talk about it, other people go, oh yeah, I felt that way as well. Or I've had those experiences, and you help them. And then by helping them, you help yourself.
Gosh, I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm sure it's that St. Francis of Assisi prayer when there's the line, it is by self-forgetting that one finds. And that is so true. And I know that when I came into early sobriety, it was don't sit at home stewing about it, get out and help people. And this is something that stayed with me, just like you, throughout my life, that I'm quite I'm an empathetic person, and that if somebody is struggling, and I've got to be careful as well, because not everybody wants your support. Sometimes I've learned that people just want to offload, and I'm a bit like the doctor. I come up with the emotional prescription. I identify with where they are, and often it's they just want space to speak, and I've learned to acknowledge that this person is offloading. They just want to speak, and if they want to hear what my response is, then they will ask for it. But I do think it's a lovely place to be in your life when you are able to do that. And I find myself now at that age, I've got time on my hands to help people. But like you, Danny, we sometimes have to pull back and think, okay, is this the right place for me to go? Should I really dip in here or just focus on myself for a little bit? So do you think that there could be a book, and you think that that might lead to motivational speaking, because often the two go hand in glove together?
100%, yeah. I think that would be very meaningful. And I do quite a bit of writing at the moment. So I write on LinkedIn and just to get my thoughts out there and to, you know, because I think it's very difficult to think. And I think writing and talking is an outlet for thinking. So sometimes it's when we talk and we write, we sort of structure our thoughts and make sense of it.
Absolutely.
So I do a lot of that.
And also, I think, as I said to you before, with your LinkedIn post, that each one of those posts can be a chapter that just then fuels your imagination for padding it out. So we're now at that stage in the show where there's two things. One is you're going to share a quote that has the most impact on you, and then you're going to ask me a question. So what's your quote?
So my quote that's had an impact on me is, "Comparison is the thief of joy." So when I was suffering with pretty severe social anxiety, I was always comparing myself to other people. And I think that's a bad idea. And the main reason it's a bad idea is because when you compare yourself, you're comparing yourself to the version of them that you've created in your mind. You don't know their struggles. You don't know their darkness. You don't know what they're going through. You only see the polished bit. So instead, I play a more interesting game. And that game is that I compare myself to who I was yesterday. So as long as I improve, it doesn't matter how small that improvement is, that's a win for me. And I found that in that striving for improving myself, I've gained a huge amount of joy, because I think it's progress that brings joy and happiness.
Yeah, I love that. And I think there's a saying in AA, that it's just progress, not perfection, because if we hold ourselves to an ideal of being perfect, we're going to become disenchanted and then we'll berate ourselves. So I think progress is so important, and I really like that quote, and I also like your thinking behind why you chose it. So we're now at the stage, have you got a question for me?
Yes, I do. So in the time that I've known you, I found you to be a very warm person. You have a real zest for life. You're always helping people. You're always imparting your wisdom and all the knowledge that you've gained, and you're not holding on to it. And what I also love about you is that you have the courage to be vulnerable. You're authentic. You know, you're not trying to make yourself into something you're not. So based on what we discussed about childhood and core beliefs and rules for life, my question to you is, what words of advice would you give to your younger self, to young Dee?
Oh, wow, to young Dee. So I guess I'd go to the age of 8 when mum and dad got divorced, because before then it was a fairly basically normal working class childhood. What advice would I give to her? I think, would it be advice, or would it be that I would put an arm around her and I would say, you're doing okay, you've been dealt a rough hand. And so don't berate yourself. Don't think what's wrong with you. Just recognise that you're actually quite courageous, that you are at a point in your life when the adults are in control. And by virtue of your age, you have zero control. So instead of going in and berating yourself, actually flipping praise yourself for doing your best in what are pretty unpleasant circumstances that went on for a few years. And yeah, I definitely think that, because as a young girl, I would berate myself. Why am I having panic attacks? Why have I got obsessive thoughts? Why can't I get out of bed on a morning as a little person? Because I'm so consumed with fear. And I used to think, what is wrong with me? When really that arm around me would have said, there's nothing wrong with you. You're actually being let down by the adults in your life. And now I look back and think, gosh, I was quite a courageous little girl. But at the time, I was sort of hell-bent on really chastising myself for having the physical and mental symptoms of a less than idyllic childhood. I don't know how that sounds to you, Danny.
That sounds amazing. And I love that you mentioned about compassion, because life is hard enough and we're all trying our best and we're doing what we can with just, you know, what we have. And I think it's important to have compassion for our past self, you know, because also by having compassion, you're also recognizing growth, because you can only have compassion if you've grown. So as you've grown and become, you know, the person you are now, you can look back and go, actually, no, that younger version of myself was just doing their best with what they had at the time. And yeah, I think that's beautiful. And with compassion, you then allow yourself to experience joy, because you're not berating yourself. You're just accepting yourself for who you are and just recognizing that you're on a journey and you're doing the best you can.
Absolutely. Well, that brings us to the end of our time together, Danny. I have absolutely loved this conversation with you, and I think you're going to inspire so many of our wonderful listeners. So thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Dee. Been an absolute pleasure.
So let me just talk about you for a little bit now, and I really hope that Danny has inspired you. And what it's made me think is we need more Dannys in this world, don't we? Authentic, relatable, mentally resilient, but flawed and fabulous individuals. And my message for you today is a simple one. Go for it. You can spend all your time sitting in your comfort zone, not daring to venture outside of it because you might be judged, the project might be too big for you. But just go for it. Go for it. Surround yourself with people that get you, that will support you. And if you're a positive disruptor, thrive on that label. And as usual, I just want you to put a big hug around yourself, step into your circle of power, and know that you are more than enough for the next stage in your life. So until next week, that's me, Dee Blick. Lead well, live well on UK Health Radio, sending you a massive virtual hug.
You've been listening to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio.